Welcome, everyone, to From Idea to Impact, the podcast from Arabella Advisors. My name is Rick Cruz, and I'm Arabella's Chief Revenue Officer. I have the pleasure today to introduce you to Nicole Lynn Lewis, an amazing leader, social entrepreneur, and friend, whose work is so timely as we consider the disruption to young people's lives due to the public health crisis and economic uncertainty in our country, especially in Black and brown communities. Nicole immediately came to mind for me when I was asked to host an episode of our podcast series. She and I spoke recently via Zoom, covering lots of topics and themes, and I'm looking forward to your learning more about her and her organization, Generation Hope. Please enjoy. Nicole, thank you so much for joining today. You immediately came to mind as I was thinking about a person, a story, and a person leading an organization who's really meeting the moment this year. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I got your email and was super excited. So I'm really glad to be here.
Excellent. I'm going to jump right in. I'm going to start with what I think is, at least I thought was a really exciting piece of news about you and Generation Hope, which is just a few weeks ago, you were named as one of 31 Black leaders nationally by the Black Voices for Black Justice Fund. Can you maybe start off by telling me what that award's all about?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing and pretty exciting. And it's an initiative that is started by some really phenomenal leaders in the philanthropic sector. Wes Moore of the Robin Hood Foundation and John King with EdTrust, Dr. John King with EdTrust, among others. And really, it's about addressing the race equity gaps in philanthropy, just understanding how little funding actually ends up in the hands of leaders of color, particularly Black leaders, and to advance the initiatives that, you know, we're working on that we know are going to address some of the most pressing problems in our communities. And many people don't know, but I think it's only like 0.6% of all foundation giving goes to Black female leaders. So there's such work that needs to be done in terms of making sure that philanthropy is more equitable and making sure that the people who are in the community and of the community doing the work are actually have the resources to advance solutions. And so this fund really came out of that and, you know, trying to put those resources in the hands of Black leaders across the country and also to elevate their platform, to elevate and amplify what each of us are doing. And I was completely blown away. I was, you know, I got the call from Dr. King and was like, oh my gosh, what, you know, what is this? And, you know, anytime as a nonprofit leader that someone calls you and says, I have great news, and it's not something you had to jump through 1,000 hoops to get, or, you know, 10 site visits, you know, this is a recognition of your hard work. So it was, I'm incredibly humbled by it. I the other honorees are just incredible, as well as the folks who started the fund, including actress Kerry Washington. And in fact, when I told my staff about the award, the only thing they could hear was Kerry Washington. It was like, so is she coming here? Can we get her autograph? but no, I am very honored, and I look forward to doing more really important race equity work.
So no application process. They just came to know about you, or you were put forward and you got the award.
Yeah, I guess I was nominated by folks who were involved. I still don't know who nominated me, but they have had some really wonderful philanthropic partners and community partners involved in the fund. And so was just honored to have my name, you know, put into the hat.
Wow. What does it feel like to get honored by, you know, just like luminaries of the field, Wes Moore, John King, and Kerry Washington? I can't believe you forgot her on the first go around. You know, what, as a Black leader, being recognized by other Black leaders?
Yeah, you know, it's just an incredible feeling. And I think it's a validation of the hard work, you know, that I think we've put in to get to this point, the big visions that we have for the future. It's hard work, you know, it's really hard work, and we deal with tough issues. And I think, you know, over the past several months in particular, with the national kind of racial reckoning that's going on, it's just reinforced how hard it really is, you know, to do this work and to be up against oppression that's been in place, you know, forever, and trying to make advances. You know, I think it's such an encouragement, a recognition, a validation. And it's also, I think, particularly for the work that I do, so important for teen mothers, teen fathers, single mothers, single fathers, parents who are working hard every single day, often with a lot of stigma and negativity that follows them. And just to feel like they've been seen in this award and that they've been validated and encouraged means a lot to me too.
Let's go back there for a second. We started in 2020, but if we could go back to when you were a teenager and when your part of your story started and when Generation Hope was in some ways born, could you take us back there and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I always tell people my story is very intricately linked with the story of Generation Hope. I was a teen mom myself. I got pregnant my senior year of high school, just at the point at which I had just received a bunch of different acceptance letters into various colleges across the country. You know, for me growing up, college was always a given. My parents raised my sister and I and really thinking about college as that's the next step after high school. So that's really where I was headed. I was an honor roll student, college bound. And even with all of that going for me, when people found out I was pregnant, they told me your life is over. You're not going to college. You're not going to be successful. And I thought, now more than ever, you know, how important is it that I get my college degree, because I am going to be a mom. So I enrolled at the College of William and Mary when my daughter was a little under 3 months old. And I always tell people I stepped foot on that campus and thought, these feet don't belong here. I was surrounded by people with a ton of resources and family support, and they didn't have parenting responsibilities like I did. And I didn't know where my tuition money was coming from, my book money was coming from. I was a new mom and a new college student, and I had a lot working against me. Very intimidating. But I thought, you know what, let me just put one foot in front of the other and see where it takes me. And that's what I did. And over the next 4 years, I experienced many of the hardships and the challenges that my students experience, in that financially it was really difficult. I had to make tough decisions between, you know, baby wipes and diapers and a textbook for class and trying to figure out how do you keep the heat on in the winter and food on the table. And then even emotionally, I was an anomaly at William & Mary. It was hard for other students to understand why I couldn't come to the library for a 9 p.m. study group, because I would have a screaming toddler coming with me. But at the same time, it was so transformational and just opened me up to new opportunities and new experiences and people that I would never have been exposed to had I not gone to college. So I walked across the graduation stage in 4 years. I graduated with high honors, and my daughter held my hand as we walked across the stage. And just an incredible moment to achieve something that people tell you is impossible. And I moved up to the DC area. I started working for a little company called Geico. You may have heard of them. Started doing PR for them and, you know, flying on Warren Buffett's jet to meet with VPs of a $1 billion company. It was very clear how much my life had been transformed. And then I was also working on my master's degree. And then slowly, I moved into the nonprofit sector, and without knowing it, really gave myself a training ground for effective nonprofit management. And I was looking for an organization to volunteer with that was focused on college completion for teen parents, and none existed in the DC region and very, very few across the country. And I thought, you know what? This is something that needs to exist. And there was this statistic that just completely floored me. And it was that less than 2% of teen moms get a degree before age 30. And I thought, that's unacceptable, and started Generation Hope really from ground zero to basically address a gap in services that needed to be addressed.
So effectively going from imposter syndrome on steroids to a private jet to realizing that you had a lot to contribute to others just like you.
Yes. And there was some imposter syndrome on the jet as well. I did not feel 100% like I belonged on that jet.
That's a pretty spectacular story. What is it about what Generation Hope provides young parents that so speaks to the needs that you had 20 years ago?
I just had someone ask me that question the other day, and it's really an interesting question. Kind of what's the secret sauce? A big thing for us is that we support the whole student. And when we say the whole student, I mean, anything that could possibly be going on in the lives of our students, we are there to help them through it. So whether it's a tumultuous relationship, a domestic violence incident, for example, with your partner, we are there to help you. If you're ready to leave, we're there to help you get connected. to a safe situation, to a shelter. We'll take you to the emergency room. We provide emergency funding so that if you needed to quickly find a new place to live, we can provide the resources to do that. And so there, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, that's not really our wheelhouse, because from my experience, I mean, life is just happening. You know, it's happening while you're trying to get your college degree, and those life interruptions, the things that you know, you can't control just by studying more at night, or, you know, what, you know, that kind of thing, or a tuition check being at the bursar's office. Those are the things that often derail students from making it to the graduation stage, particularly when you have the incredible responsibilities of parenting. You know, there are so many things that can interrupt your college journey. And so I knew that from my own experience, housing, you know, I was homeless for a period of time. I was in a really bad relationship with my daughter's father. The financials of, you know, trying to make all the dots connect. Those were probably harder, honestly, than my studies. And so I think that I took that experience into what we do at Generation Hope, and that's been crucial for us. So we have a licensed mental health counselor on our staff. So if there's any sort of mental health challenge that comes up, not only for parents, but also for their children, we can provide that direct counseling. You know, so we do, I don't want to say we do it all, because we certainly don't do it all, but there's nothing that's off limits for us. And when we don't do it internally, we have a really robust community network with other organizations and agencies that we can go to help with a need.
Yeah. It feels like over the last couple of decades, the ecosystem of nonprofits and post-secondary institutions have gotten smarter, better, dedicated more resources to serving students from vulnerable communities, helping them complete college. I hazard to say they're not, maybe not as focused on students who are also parenting. So have they learned anything from your experience and from Generation Hope?
So I often call student parents the invisible population, because I think that we have made really great strides in many ways with student groups, but we don't talk about student parents enough and intersectionality between student parents and other groups. We know they're more likely to be students of color. They're more likely to be low-income students. They're more likely to be first-generation students. And we definitely talk about those groups, but we don't talk about when there's intersectionality with parenting. And it's such an important piece of the puzzle. We know that parenting college students have higher GPAs than their peers, but they're less likely to graduate. You know, they're not making it to the graduation stage at the rate that we need them to and that they should be. And that speaks to our lack of support and higher ed's need to really see this population, value this population, and invest in this population. About 22% of all undergraduate students are parenting. It's about 1 in 5 college students across the country. And when we look at race and ethnicity, for example, it's almost half of all Black female undergraduate students across the country are parenting. So it's a significant population, but it's one that, again, we just aren't talking about enough. And one big piece of that is that most colleges and universities are not tracking the parenting status of their students. So it becomes really difficult to address their needs, talk about the types of investments that need to be made, even track their college completion rates at your institution when you're not tracking parenting status. So there's a lot of work to be done. I think there have been great strides in many ways in higher ed, and a real understanding that most of today's college students are not, quote unquote, the traditional students that we envision. But we've got a lot of work to do in terms of recognizing the needs of parenting students.
Those are stunning numbers. And what you're telling me is that we oftentimes don't have a good sense at a local or a national level how many of those students are making it through. And you know, as we see in so many other things, if you can't quantify it, if you can't measure it, we're not actually putting the resources against it. So
exactly.
Does Generation Hope have a policy agenda as well? Like, how are you trying to influence the larger conversation?
Yes, we do. So I think, you know, we just celebrated 10 years in March, and it's really been an opportunity for us over the past couple of years to think about how do we broaden our impact. And I think exactly what you're speaking to, how can we really contribute to the work that needs to be done outside of the DC area, in the DC area, but also outside of the DC area. And so we have a couple ways that we're going to do that. One is that we're launching a technical assistance program for colleges and universities that will really allow us to take our best practices that we've honed over the past 10 years and help institutions figure out how to adapt those for their campuses to increase college graduation rates and completion rates for parenting college students at their institution. And so we're really excited about that because, you know, it has implications. If more institutions are really adopting some of these different practices and using a student parent lens across their institution, then that means, you know, we could really impact the lives of millions of students across the country. So we're excited about the potential that's there with helping institutions come to this work. And then second, we are launching a policy and advocacy agenda. And that one of the most exciting things about that agenda is that it's going to be driven by student parents. So we're going to be engaging our students in the DC region, but we're also going to be engaging student parents across the country and having them tell us what are those pieces of legislation, what are those initiatives that are either hindering your success or accelerating your success. And then taking all of that and building out a policy and advocacy agenda for the organization. And we feel like that really gets to those systemic barriers that are in place that we need to try to clear the path for more parenting students, more teen parents, more parenting students to get to the graduation stage.
You know, amidst in 2020, thinking about what the country is going through and will continue to go through far longer than we had all hoped, dealing with COVID, finally perhaps reconciling with race and racism. Your program stands for something so powerful in terms of giving young parents economic mobility. And I've had the privilege of being at your events, oftentimes with tears running down my cheeks, hearing the stories of young women and families talking about the transformative impact. And they don't take it just from the education lens. They're talking about getting on solid economic footing. And I've really appreciated that about the work that you've done and the way you've positioned it. Can you maybe say a little bit more about that, about really that broad perspective on probably apropos the award that you got, justice, more than anything else?
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And I think there are so many wonderful ROIs about a college degree. And one that we talk about a lot is as you said, allowing families to move into family-sustaining careers and to move into fulfilling careers and their passions and their interests, but allowing them to also provide for their families in ways, again, that they might not have been able to without a college degree. That is definitely social justice work. And particularly, we have 90% of our families are families of color. And so we definitely see that this work is I always tell people that student parent work is race equity work because it is about creating socioeconomic mobility for families. And particularly when we think about teen parents in particular, they, you know, the children of teen parents are 10 times more likely to live in poverty. They enter kindergarten at lower levels of school readiness than their peers. So there's so many generational implications for when we help a young parent earn their college degree, what happens in the lives of their children, what happens in the lives of their grandchildren and the legacies of education that they're creating in their families. And that's something that we really feel passionate about and are really proud of in our work.
The work tackles real and oftentimes perceived or manufactured barriers. And, you know, given the firsthand experience that you bring to this, is there an anecdote, something someone said to you that was just awful and dispiriting at those moments where you were really struggling to keep it together and keep it going?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was in college, one thing that really stuck with me, I remember being asked to come and speak to a youth group about being a teen mom in college and kind of what I was up against and my experience. And I remember being at my daughter's daycare and there were a couple of other moms around and they were immediately kind of concerned about my talking to these young people. And it was almost as if teen pregnancy was contagious, that it was dangerous for me to, you know, be talking to people about my experience. And that was disheartening. And I think it really speaks to, you know, people's misunderstanding about teen pregnancy and really about what's going on in the lives of young people today. But it also, for me, felt very much like a silencer and, you know, a way to kind of keep my story away from people, you know, because of a fear. And I think that speaks to the larger stigma that we have around teen pregnancy and teen parenting. And you know, I love this quote from the United Nations. They released a report on global adolescent pregnancy several years ago. And they talked about teen pregnancy is less about an intentional choice and more about a lack of choices in a young person's life. Mm-hmm. And I think we often think about it in, you know, in the way where these are intentional choices. And really, when you get to the root of teen pregnancy and parenting, it is about a powerlessness in young people's lives and a lack of choices. And that's the way that we need to be talking about it and addressing the needs of young people. So I think that was one point where I realized just how heavy the stigma was, in a very personal way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are certainly telling the story, or have been telling the story every day now for 10 years in the most tangible way, which is your motivating action. And now you have this amazing platform to tell the story, and you're not shy and shouldn't be shy about telling that. And now next spring, you're publishing a book.
Yes. This is in the face of all the moms at that daycare.
Exactly. This is for the moms at that daycare. It's titled, I believe, Pregnant Girl. And there are a lot of names that you could have gone with. What does that name mean for you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, naming a book is like one of the hardest things that I think anyone has ever done. It's like not an easy thing. And so it was a lot of conversations with my agent and my publisher and kind of figuring it out. And then also sometimes you start a book and you think the title's going to be one thing and then you finish it and it feels like it's something else. So it was just a journey to come to it. But I think what we wanted was something that immediately spoke to the tensions and the complexity, I think, of teen parenting and teen pregnancy. And I think that title gets right to it. It's kind of like, what is that about? You know, and yet it's accurate in many ways. So it was a journey to get there. But I think we all, when we said it, we were like, oh my gosh, that's it. It just felt like it really fit.
Yeah. Pregnant Girl, Kick-Ass Leader. I'll add a subtitle to it.
Let me write that down.
I want credit for that. In a world and a time where we need to center a whole lot more of our work around people's who have the lived experiences to really solve some of our most pressing challenges, you represent that in so many ways. And I just wonder, what role do you find yourself playing mentoring other leaders? What advice you give to other leaders on how they can take their story and their power and make change of it?
Something that I've done since I started Generation Hope is I always reserve time on my calendar every week for people who want advice on starting nonprofits. And that's been something that I've been really passionate about, because I had people who were willing to sit down with me, founders, before I even started Generation Hope, to tell me, you know, here are some words of advice, here's something that, you know, that is really important for you to think about and consider. So I've been really committed to that. And even when my calendar looks a hot mess, which it often does, I try to keep that sacred and try to let people know, hey, this is the day, you know, if people have questions. And that's important to me, to be available. I think that's the way that I can mentor and give back and hopefully answer questions for people. And you know, provide some lessons learned that help them to maneuver around some obstacles. But that's really important to me. And I also hope the book, you know, I talk in the book about launching Generation Hope and some of the things that I was up against and being a leader of color, a Black female nonprofit leader. And I'm hoping the book offers, you know, kind of my blueprint, if you will, and kind of how I approach this work and how I handled some of the obstacles that I was up against, and really talking about the need for more equity in philanthropy. And I'm hoping that also paves the way or removes some barriers for leaders who are coming after me as well.
You don't accomplish what you have without making some hard decisions, maybe even some mistakes. Any stories to share on either of those?
No mistakes.
Just one.
Rick.
Just
Everything
one.
Everything was meticulously planned. Mistakes. You know, I don't know that this is a mistake, but I think what I can tell you, the smartest decisions that I've made And that has helped me avoid some mistakes. And I think number one is that I have brought people into the Generation Hope community at the staff and board level who are incredible and who are talented and who are hugely committed to what we do and our families and are very successful in kind of launching ventures and scaling. And I think that has been one of the best decisions that I could have made and continue to make every day in terms of how we bring people into the community. And I think that has helped me avoid many mistakes because I feel like I have mentors on my board. I have mentors on my staff, people I learn from who can really help us try to, you know, maneuver around, I think, some pitfalls, especially for organizations like Generation Hope. We've experienced a lot of growth in 10 years. You know, I started in my husband's man cave in 2010, and now we have 15 full-time employees and an office in DC. And a $2 million plus budget. And so I think, you know, growing that quickly, we've been really helped by having incredibly talented, smart people around the table. And I'm thankful for that. And I also recruit a lot of people I just enjoy, you know, enjoy doing the work with. And I think that's important because, as you said, we, you know, we're dealing with tough things every single day and just enjoying the team and having fun together in the midst of some really tough stuff is really important. So I feel like I did a really political way of answering your question by not giving you any mistakes. But I do think that that has been, I always say that has been one of the best pieces of advice I would give to someone growing an organization.
Yeah. It's a very good point. I think it's oftentimes missed how you when you're doing this type of hard, draining, emotional work, you need to find joy in the people that are around you. And it's great that you've been able to do that on so many levels. You touched upon this a little bit ago, but what are the challenges for you that have presented as a Black female leader in leading an organization and having to, you know, face a lot of different obstacles?
Yeah, I think one big thing is getting into the room. You know, that's a really hard thing as a leader of color to get in the right rooms with the right people who can help you grow your vision and your organization. And I think that is something, you know, I definitely experienced early on, just not having the connections, the network to be able to get to the person who might be able to write a check to the organization or provide some sort of pro bono support for our scholars. And that is very real. I just gave a really good example of, I received an award a couple years ago, and, you know, from this kind of major publication in the DC region. And they, as a part of the award, they have a big banquet with like all the, you know, kind of movers and shakers in the region from a business standpoint. And the best thing you could do as a nonprofit in that room is kind of bring your people, right? Bring your board, bring your staff, or at least, you know, a subset of them to help you work the room, you know, talk about Generation Hope. And the tables were $5,000 each. And for us as an organization, it was not something at that point, you know, that we were able to purchase. And so I was able to, I can't even remember how I got a ticket for my husband. That's how bad it was, Rick. I was like, can I at least have my husband here to see me get this award? And so, but I shared with that publication a couple weeks ago, the fact that that put me in a different space as a nonprofit that was able, or a business that was able to purchase a table or two tables. We even saw some awardees being able to do that. So I think that's a great example, is like getting in the room is hard enough. And once you're in the room, being able to really, you know the people and have the resources to work the room to benefit your organization, you know, those are very real hurdles for sure. And particularly as you're growing your organization and trying to take it to the next level. And then the last thing I'll say is, you know, now that we're moving into this national work and building upon the work that we do in DC, you know, being an organization that's provided direct services for the past 10 years and trying to get into the national landscape of nonprofits is not easy. And I think particularly, you know, for a woman of color, being able to get that seat at the table to start to have policy conversations, to start to have broader systemic conversations is not easy. And I think that's something that I'm still feeling, you know, today is again, how do you get that seat around the table?
Yeah. Well, you've earned that seat. So let's work to make sure you get that seat. Just a few final questions. You're such an inspiring figure. You really are. Who inspires you?
Oh gosh, so many people, Rick. One person that I talk about a lot is my grandmother. My grandmother is 96 years old. And her career was homemaker, and she cared for my mom and her two siblings and my grandfather before he passed away. And my grandmother just taught me so much about love and unconditional love and just how to make people feel special and valued. And she didn't have a college degree. She didn't have a career. She didn't have a driver's license. So in terms of how the world views kind of what's most important, she probably wouldn't pass that test, but she was a connector and kind of the glue, I think, for us in terms of, you know, growing up. It was just like you wanted to be at her house. As soon as you walked in, she made you feel special. And I think it just taught me a lot about what's important in the world. And that's really like how you make people feel and how you take care of them and how you show up for them. And that's something that I think is important to me as a mother and as a wife. And certainly as a nonprofit leader, I think we never want to do this work without remembering that we have to make people feel loved and valued. And if we're not doing that, then we're failing, no matter what our metrics say.
I get the sense that that's how you make every one of those young people who Generation Hope works with feel. So
you're
following well in her footsteps. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today, joining me today. I've just loved getting to know you over these last couple of years. And I know everyone that listens to this will feel that same way.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really, really fun and enjoyable. And I'll do it again. I'll come back.
Lots more stories to tell.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.